All right, and here we are to the great section on Trivium Skills. Hopefully you've been following well enough to this point, and if you still seem a bit confused, maybe go back and listen to some of the earlier part of the presentation. But otherwise, if you're ready, let's get on with the show. The format here in this second part of the presentation is going to be pretty simple. I'm going to be playing one clip from Adler's How to Read a Book DVD for each Trivium skill that I'm outlining. And then actually there will be one skill in particular that comes from a different source, but that'll be the last one, and I think you'll enjoy that as well. After each clip, I'm just going to provide a little bit of commentary, very short. I'm going to keep those comments as brief as possible and just let Adler and Van Doren and the rest do the talking. Although one section on the paraphrase skill I will spend some time on, but we'll get to that later. So I think that's pretty much it. After the skill section is finished, I'm just going to provide you with a few suggested reading materials, some links, resources, and then address a few criticisms that people have of the liberal education path. So, you know, if there are any of those types of questions you have, I will be addressing them at the end. If I do miss your question, then please send it in, thenextsteppodcast@gmail.com, and I will answer it for you, as well as incorporate it into a second version of this presentation, which will come about at some point in the future. You know, I'm going to be working this presentation and improving it when I can in my amounts of free time. But pretty much this presentation, once it's a wrap, it's just my gift to you. Use it as well as you possibly can, and remember that these skills are meant to be incorporated into your habitual life of thought. You want to use them as much as you can, and then get to a point where they're just sort of always there in your mind, so that when you encounter a piece of information, you don't have to really spend too much conscious thought and energy pulling up this skill, like, oh, I'm going to define terms now. You're just automatically going to do these things. That's the real goal here that I'm hoping you're going to achieve while presenting you these Trivium skills, because it's the combination of the Trivium skills and the Trivium method that is going to allow you to attack any subject, to learn anything, okay? And it's a really powerful combination when you can make it a habitual thing. So, yeah, unless there's any questions, we're going to get going here. And, okay, nobody's raising their hand. All right, then. Here is the first clip from Adler and Van Doren, How to Read a Book, the DVD version.
Mortimer, we're going to be talking about how to read a book, and I brought you some books to read.
What do you mean by reading? Reading is a highly ambiguous word. It can mean any number of things.
Yeah.
You mean reading for information, reading for just amusement and relaxation, or reading for understanding, reading by which I'm going to lift my mind up from understanding less to understanding more. Which?
Well, all three. I mean, the books that I brought you, I think, are susceptible of reading in all those three different ways. And
I can tell, by the way, by looking at them, which way I want to read them, if I'm going to read them at all. And I brought you some books. You take these and look at these while I look at yours.
All right.
This is a book I've wanted to read for a long time, but read very lightly. It's a book by Merle Miller, which is the oral biography of Harry S. Truman. I've read reviews of it, and I know what it contains. It's the story of Truman's political life and his presidency, told in the first person by his recording it. I know I want to read that book quickly. It wouldn't take me much time to read it.
This is Toynbee on Toynbee, and there's a long description of the book right on the cover. A conversation between Arnold J. Toynbee and G.R. Urban on topics of perennial and current interest. And since Toynbee is one of the great authors of our century, I am sure that I would want to read that, but not.
Well, I know I don't want to read this. I know that I don't even want to glance at it more than the cover. It's a Rand McNally book all about bicycling. Charles, I'm sorry to tell you, I've never been able to keep my balance on a bicycle. That's
well,
that.
Well, maybe that would help you to do
no,
it.
No, I assure you, no book. This is a how-to book.
Mm-hmm.
And no book would ever be able to, I'd never be able to go from a book to staying up on a bicycle.
Well, what if we ran out of gas completely?
I'd walk.
Right. Oh, you did do well by me, didn't you? Now, here's a book by I.A. Richards, the philosopher. It's called Beyond. the sources and aims of the Western tradition from the Iliad and Job to Plato, Dante, and Shelley. And I think I'd probably want to read that book. It is a complex book with a analytical table of contents, Mortimer, which is something that books used to have.
That's right.
With a quite distinct and well-described analysis of what's in the book. I will read I.A. Richards.
Charles, I've got the last three books you laid out for me, but why did you give me Hamlet? You know I've read that.
Yeah, well, I know you've read it, but there
that's
are...
That's a book I'd read carefully. I've read it 10, 15 times already.
There are notes in it.
Oh.
And every page is printed on every other page, and every other page, therefore, contains notes and commentary and so forth. Well, and I thought that might be interesting and useful.
Well, Hamlet, against all the books you've given me, this is the only one that I would read. I have read 10, 15 times, perhaps, mm-hmm. in the course of years of reading, slowly, carefully, understanding a little more each time I've read it. This is the only book you've given me that I would put in the class of reading for the sake of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
The rest, I mean, the sense of improving my mind, understanding my own life and human life better than I would have without reading it. These other books, the Truman book would amuse me, entertain me, and inform me. The other books are strictly books of information. They're not going to teach me anything beyond facts that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to me is that distinction between books that one reads for information, or magazines or newspapers, books that one reads for amusement, such as detective stories or light novels or current fiction of some kind or other, and books that one reads to improve one's understanding is very important for the following reason. All of us learn to read in school, and that instruction in reading goes on to the fourth or sixth grade. Now, for most of these books, the kind of reading you learn to do up to the fourth or sixth grade is quite sufficient. You've got enough skill to read the newspaper.
Although you have to practice it. You have to keep on using it.
But to read Hamlet, or to read other books that are worth reading for the sake of improving your mind, you need skills that are not taught in school. In fact, the kind of reading that I think we should be talking about from now on, mm-hmm. in this, is reading that is not taught in school at all.
Mm-hmm.
Reading that involves acts of interpretation, acts of analysis, acts of apprehension of content in the book.
And acts of critical judgment.
Right.
After you've finished.
Now, that kind of reading cannot be done quickly.
No, I don't think it can either. How fast would you read Hamlet, Mortimer, if you were reading it...
For the first time?
Well, for the first time, yeah.
I'd read it more quickly the first time than the second and third time. But let me say about the speed of reading that there's no such thing as a right speed.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm reading Plato, for example, or Aristotle, I seldom read faster than 20 pages an hour, sometimes slower than that.
Well, that's pretty slow, isn't it?
In fact, I would guess, Charles, that reading in the sense, that third sense of reading, reading for the sake of really lifting my mind up from a state of understanding less to understanding more, I doubt if I read 10 books a year. I handle hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
I examine many. I get information from a great many. I get pleasure from the books I read at night to go to sleep with. But I assure you, the books that I learn from in a genuine sense of deepening my mind, gaining insight and some degree of wisdom, I hope, I doubt if I read 10 a year. Because I read them very slowly. It's hard work. I read them at a desk. Usually at a desk with pencil and paper, marking the book. And therefore, it seems to me that the whole cult of speed reading is wrong.
Yes, I think you're right.
Instead of talking about speed reading, one should talk about variable speed reading. Everyone should be able to read some things very quickly, particularly if their purposes are light and transient, and some things very, very slowly. The trouble is that most people don't know how to read slowly enough.
Yes, I think that's true when it comes to a really, really good book. Speed reading is useful for learning how to read business memos or business letters or something of the sort quickly.
I don't think I'd recommend it for contracts or leases.
No, nor for love letters.
Or for love letters.
No, love letters should be read very slowly. Now, in the case of Hamlet, for example, suppose you didn't know what that play was and hadn't read it before. You're saying that, first of all, you'd like to find out some things about it from kind of exterior cues like its title and its author's name and when it was written and its cast of characters.
This copy of Hamlet you gave me, I wouldn't want. On my first reading of Hamlet, I don't want to be stopped by the notes.
Right.
I don't want footnotes. I don't want to I want to read it through quickly. In
right.
fact, my feeling about a difficult book, a book that's worth reading carefully, is that the first time you read it, you should read it very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the first time, expecting to read it again much more slowly. And quickly in the sense of not being stopped.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of allusions in Hamlet that I wouldn't understand the first time, which the notes would help me
mm-hmm.
understand better.
Right.
But on that first reading, I don't want to understand everything. I want to understand enough to get the whole play in before me.
Because it's so terribly important to understand the whole structure
That's
of
right.
a book before you start to read it in detail and understand it in detail, isn't it?
When I went to high school many, many years ago, we read Julius Caesar, as mm-hmm. I think the first year of high school. We read it scene by scene,
mm-hmm.
understanding each scene. As a result, I never understood the play as a whole.
Yes.
Well, what they should have done instead of reading it scene by scene first is to read the play through completely and discuss it as a whole and then go back, perhaps, and read it more carefully, mm-hmm. scene by scene, with notes and explanations.
I had the same experience with As You Like It, and as a matter of fact, because my father was a poet and a professor of English and a teacher of Shakespeare, he said, read As You Like It all the way through sure. the night before. And I did it, and I came to school the next day, and the teacher was annoyed with me because I had spoiled her plan. And yet I had done something very important for myself because I was able to understand what she was doing henceforth.
I'm so convinced about this that when I've been reading great books with students or with adults in great book seminars, I always tell them, when I give them a difficult text for discussion to read it through and not be stopped by what they don't understand
yeah.
on the first reading. Because only by reading it through and understanding, let's say, 10% or 20% or 30% will they be able to go back and understand more. One example I'm very fond of is a great treatise in the Summa Theologica by Thomas Aquinas, one of the treatises that I think is most instructive and illuminating, the treatise on law.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had people that I've asked to read this get stopped because when they get, it's really questions 90 to 97 or 98, about 8 or 9 questions. And on the second of those questions, 92, Article 6 is the question whether there is a law in the foams of sin, F-O-M-E-S.
Foams
of sin.
What are foams?
And people stop reading. They say, well, I don't know what foams are. I can't find it in the dictionary, a small dictionary. And so they stop reading because they can't understand that particular passage.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said to them, go first place, if you don't understand that one passage, it will not affect your general grasp of the treatise on law. In the second place, if you look at the context, you'll get some sense of the foams of sin, the passions. You'll see the discussion here of the passions
mm-hmm.
as the sources of the animal passions, as the sources of original sin, the causes of Adam's fall. And after you've read the treatise on law through, you'll be able to go back and understand better why St. Thomas asks whether there's a law in the foams of sin.
Mm-hmm.
But people who get stopped by that, or for example,
what is foams? Now, what does the word
foams mean? Are substances that communicate infection. Infectious substances,
I see.
And the passions infect us with sin, you see.
Right, but you can understand that in a general way as well as you have to understand it from the context.
But if you didn't, it wouldn't make any difference because
right.
it's only one question, and if you to stop there is to defeat yourself entirely. Go on reading, you see.
Another example of that is the first canto of the Divine Comedy of Dante. Many people get hung up on that first canto mm-hmm. because as Dante is traveling through the world, he comes to himself in the middle of a dark wood in the middle of the journey of his life, and he meets a leopard and a she-wolf and a lion, and these are highly allegorical mm-hmm. figures, and Dante doesn't really explain what they mean. And I have known readers who said, I can't go on because I don't know what those animals mean. It does not matter. As a matter of fact, Dante really never explains what they mean, but if you go on just a little bit more, Dante meets Virgil, and Virgil is the most important character after Dante and Beatrice in the book, and then the story unfolds. But don't get stuck at the beginning.
Now, you know, if you follow me in this distinction between reading for amusement or entertainment,
mm-hmm.
relaxation, and reading just for information, on the one hand, and reading for understanding, for deepening your mind, acquiring insight, lifting your mind up from a lower level to a higher level, then I think it's terribly important for each of us, for everyone, to find a number of books that are over their heads.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a person reads only books that are on the level of his head, he can't lift his head up.
Right.
It's the books that are over one's head, the books which one only partially understands it first and must work at to understand more that can possibly elevate you. You can't lift yourself up with things at your level or below your level.
Krista, you can't chin yourself on a bar that's below your
Say, that's over my head, as if that immediately dismisses it. On the contrary, what's over your head you should go after.
Right. If you pick up a book and you find it's too tough for you, you shouldn't throw it aside. I mean, that's what you're looking for. You should be happy when you find a book that's too hard for you, because that's a book that you can grow with. That's a book that you can lift yourself up with.
And the art of reading consists in knowing how to do just that.
Right.
The art of reading, I'd like to say, consists in having the skills required for lifting your mind up with a book, and nothing but a book in your hand, from understanding less to understanding more.
All right. So there, Adler and Van Doren are introducing you to the concept of reading for understanding, which is interesting. In the American culture, at least, we have a few little slogans. One is the more you know, okay, and then the other one is knowledge is power. And if we refer to the trivium method, you have grammar, logic, and rhetoric, the metaphorical method of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, but also we call it knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, okay? And so here you have knowledge representing just the grammar stage. Now, if that's all you had throughout your whole life, you really don't have power. Knowledge is not power. Understanding is power. And that's what Adler is talking about. You want to read something in order to understand it, not just to know it, not just to be able to repeat it. You want to know, you want to understand what it means, truly. Okay, and so he's also drawing these distinctions of the types of materials that you are reading. Informative materials, entertaining, and then uplifting. Things that are going to uplift your mind. Go from a state of understanding less to understanding more. All right, very, very key ideas. So this is a skill that you want to just have embedded in your mind, this discernment, which isn't to say that you shouldn't read things for entertainment or information, but that you should be making a conscious effort to read things for upliftment, okay? And by that, you know, Adler will say, read the best books that we have around, you know, the great works of Western civilization and such. And I agree. I think they're a great way to build your mind up. It's not just to know what Aristotle said. It's to come in contact with his thinking process, with his great mind. So, that's pretty much it. So we're going to head on to the next section here, which is taking notes.
Mortimer, you're a smart guy. Why does it take you so long to read?
Well, it sometimes takes me long and sometimes a short time to read a book. I can read 10 books in one day in the sense of inspecting them, finding out what they're about, and putting them on my shelf for future reference.
And deciding whether you want to read them or not.
Carefully or not. But just as I can read 10 books in one day, sometimes it takes me 10 days to read one book, or even longer than 10 days, because I'm really working at it. I'm trying to make that book part of myself. I'm trying to find out everything it says and understand everything it means and think about and criticize what I've learned from it. And when I do that, I'm working. I'm not just sitting back in a chair idly. I'm not about to go to sleep. I usually read books that way at my desk with a pad and paper, seldom without a pen or a pencil in my hand. And often I find that at the end of an hour or two, I have to stop because I'm so, in a sense, weary of the work that I have to take a rest before I go on reading.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do with a pencil in my hand is to make notes in the book or about the book on a piece of paper. And I think that no one is really reading in the sense of getting the book into his mind if he doesn't do that. Just to sit there with the book in your hand and your eyes open, turning the pages, probably with your mind wandering, is not reading in my sense of the term reading.
What's that book there?
Well, I have here three books that I read carefully. These two 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
This one 40 years ago. These two I read in college when I was a student at Columbia, studying with John Dewey, and I'll tell you a story about that later. One is Reconstruction Philosophy, and the other is William James's Meaning of Truth, the
mm-hmm. right.
both pragmatic philosophers. And this, shortly after I began teaching, I became acquainted with the great French philosopher Jacques Maritain. This is a book called Art and Scholasticism. Let me tell you, let me show you what I did in this book, for example. First place, you will see here, in my unformed, childish handwriting, a series of pages of notes that I made on a pad just like that while I was reading the book.
Incidentally, by the way, before you go on, here's an example of that I did that I just discovered by going through my library. It's a book about William Cooper, the man I wrote a dissertation about. I filled up the inside of the front mm-hmm. cover with notes, but then that wasn't nearly enough, so I needed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 yeah. pages, which I cut down yeah. so that they would fit inside the book.
Well, and then in the book itself, there are underlined, there are, I put a mark in the margin to indicate that paragraph. Mm-hmm. I wanted to call attention to, or I underlined words, and sometimes not only underlined words, but wrote down on the bottom margin of the page my own observations,
yeah.
meaning my own comments on the thing, so that here at the end of the chapter
yeah.
is a set of notes. Now, the interesting thing about that, Charles, is that they were useful at the time. If, for example, I were to read this book now for discussion, or I would have to read it, I really want another copy.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, one of the reasons why I seldom use a library book, I often use library books, but when I want to do this kind of reading with them, I have to buy the book.
In yeah. simple,
because I can't mark a yeah. library book, and if I don't mark a book, I don't think I've got it, you see?
Actually, when you read a book this carefully, you are establishing a proprietary
That's right
in it anyway.
You better own it.
You have brought it into your own mind, so you better own it.
But if I wanted to read this book again for the purposes of teaching it or using it in some research, I'd want another copy to mark it freshly.
Yeah.
These earlier markings would annoy me. Because though they might be helpful, I might be interested in finding out what I thought then. 50 years later, I think something different.
Well, the marks in a book are not the record, then, for you to refer back to.
No, I don't. They're not there for memory's sake.
Yeah.
They're there because it was part of the act of reading at the time.
They do remind you of how carefully you read. I, going through my library, I found a copy of the Iliad of Homer, where I had marked almost every page. I think I made a kind of running index of the book. I was writing something about the Iliad at the time. This was 25 mm-hmm. years ago. There was an index of this, but it was not satisfactory to me. I had to make my own index as I went along of the plot and of the characters as they acted in various ways in the book. So up at the top of many of the pages, most of the pages, I have written a description of what happens on this page. I am amazed at what I said. I no longer think it's true, but that's not the important thing. What I know is that I really read that book to a fairly well.
That's exactly the same in this case of William James's essays on the meaning of truth. Both the front and back covers of the book are loaded with notes referring to pages, and of course the book itself is marked, underlined, asterisks. But
yeah,
let me say one thing about that,
yeah.
if I may. I, as you know, conduct these seminars at Aspen summer after summer. I've been doing it for the last 25 years. And many of the readings are the same summer after summer, so I've read the selections that are discussed in the seminar 25 or more times. Mm. And each time I do it, I make notes. But I can't use last year's notes. I have a whole file of notes going back many, many years with the dates on them.
Yeah.
But each time that I conduct that seminar, I read the thing again. The selection is fairly short, 30 or 40 pages. Make another set of notes, because as I've grown older, my own mind has changed, and therefore I've got to do the reading again, the thinking again, and the note-making again to be current.
Right. Here's Walter Badgett's Physics and Politics. And the important chapter in this book, there are five chapters, is the last one. And at a certain point in this chapter, Badgett begins to give the core, the heart of his argument. And what I did here was to mark the key sentences in the argument. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and finally, one page later, 14, which is the key sentence of all.
Mm-hmm.
And I have that as an eternal record of the heart and meaning of this book.
Recently, reading a book that interests me considerably, written by a professor at Harvard called Reflections on the Causes of Human Misery and Upon Certain Proposals to Eliminate Them, a book dealing with current economic and social problems, I did a very elaborate marking. As you can see, in this case here, I put question marks in the margin. I often put question marks when a sentence or a statement by an author puzzles me. And in some cases, there's a great deal of underlining here, but in one or two cases, I put down, beginning on page 171, underlining asterisk one, meaning that's the first point in the series of arguments, very much as you did in another case, and that goes on with asterisks and words encircled. And you've
turned down the corner of the page, haven't you?
And then there's asterisk and two, and asterisk and three, so that I've got a series of sentences there that I want to call my own attention to as the sequence of an argument.
Here's a copy of The Nature of the Universe by Lucretius, or On the Nature of Things, De Rerum Natura. It contains an analytical table of contents made by the translator. That is, a table of contents that doesn't just give titles of chapters, but describes...
Outlines the content of chapter
outlines
by
the
chapter.
Contents of the work. And it's very useful and very well done by the translator, but it's not my analytical table of contents, and I was teaching the book and working very hard on it, so I had to make my own. So I made my own analytical table of contents, which is somewhat different from the translator's, although in many respects, of course, it's the same because I'm dealing with the same book.
Wouldn't you say that a student who is reading the book that you were teaching should do exactly the same kind of work?
That's right. And he should argue with me if his notion of what the book says is different from mine.
Reverse of that picture, that's why I never like to lend books to anybody.
Right.
I not only don't like to use library books because I can't mark them, but I don't want to lend you this book. If you want to read The Meaning of Truth, you go out and buy your own. Because I don't want you to be affected by my notes, as
right.
you would be.
Right.
You couldn't help be affected by all the markings on the page.
I might say to myself, Mortimer Adler is crazy. He is misunderstood this. Listen, what was your story about John Dewey?
Well, at about the time that I was reading this book, John Dewey had just come back from China, was teaching a course at Columbia. I was, a junior or a senior. And his lectures were relatively slow tempo, so I could take down in notes almost everything he said. I'd go home and type these notes up and read them carefully and mark them. Then I'd write a letter. Dear Dr. Dewey, I would say, dear Professor Dewey, in today's lecture you said such and such, but it seems to me you were inconsistent with what you said 2 days before. Would you please explain? And Professor Dewey would come to class and say, a student in this class has written me a letter, and then he'd read the letter and explain. And then I'd go home and write another note saying, because I was carrying on a series of conversations with Dewey until he was so sometimes plagued by this, he said, I wish the student that's writing me these letters would stop. But actually what you're doing when you're marking a book is exactly that. You're carrying on a one-sided conversation with the author. In fact, I think that reading is that kind of thing.
Is that unfair?
No. How do you
ensure that the author's view is adequately represented in your conversation?
You can't ensure that. But
that's your effort, isn't it?
Your
first task in reading a book is to get as truly and correctly as possible what the author is saying.
Correct. But nevertheless, one of the reasons why perhaps having two people read the same book together is that they would make the conversation a little less one-sided. If I told you what I was saying to John Dewey, you could say, but I don't think Dewey says that, and mm-hmm. the conversation would become more amplified. But you know, what all this comes to, Charles, is, I think, something that most people don't realize because they don't engage in reading in this way, that reading is a very, very active process.
Yeah.
Most people think of writing as if writing were active, because they can see that a person to write has to take a typewriter out of a piece. He's doing something.
Mm-hmm.
But they think of reading as sitting back passively,
yeah.
having the words somehow go through the eyes and into the mind, mm-hmm. and no activity. After all, you're just sitting still. Mm-hmm. But reading is just as active as writing.
Yeah.
And I often like to think of the analogy of pitching and catching in a baseball game.
The catcher who kneels down there behind the batter is not passive.
He's receiving,
right.
but not passive. He's actively receiving,
right.
just as the pitcher is actively throwing. So the writer is actively communicating, and the reader is actively receiving the communication. But the actions are correlative and proportional mm-hmm. to one another, but the activities are equally intense on both sides.
It's a good catcher that makes a good pitcher, and I suppose we're saying here that a good reader makes a good author in some sense.
The reverse is also true. A good catcher can't catch a bad pitcher.
Yeah, yes, that's
and
true.
And some of the rules of reading that I think we're concerned with in this making the art of reading clear apply only to books that are well written.
Yeah.
Because if the book isn't well written enough, the rules won't work, just as a good catcher with great skill can't catch a bad pitcher.
Right.
While
it's very important to emphasize this, isn't it, that we're not recommending that you take a pencil and mark a book and indicate the points in order. If it's a book you're reading just for pleasure or amusement or entertainment, or if it's a book you're just reading for information.
How silly it would be to mark a detective story.
Right, yes.
Or make notes about a detective story.
But when you're reading to elevate your understanding, when it's your mind that's involved, and when you want to really come to grips with what the author says,
then you better make the book your own.
Right.
And you don't make it your own just by buying it.
No.
Because that's just as a piece of physical property you put on the shelf. You make it your own by putting yourself into it.
Yeah.
And you put yourself into it by mocking it.
All right, taking notes. This is kind of a no-brainer in some ways, but actually it's not as obvious as many people would think. Taking notes isn't something you can do in conversation so much, but it is something that when reading, or at least when listening to a speech or a presentation, taking notes is something that you really can do. Now, I love how Adler says to go ahead and write in your books, because I kind of had this problem growing up where I would actually want to do that. And I remember a copy of Brave New World Revisited that I acquired, and I started underlining the words that I didn't know. And I felt really bad because it seemed like you're just not supposed to write in books. Now, I'd always seen books that were the product of college kids, and they were all highlighted and marked up. But it always kind of aggravated me when I got one of those books because it was very distracting. And then also, the things that they made notes of are not necessarily things I would think to make notes of, and it was just, yes, very distracting. So there is like this really big cultural stigma about writing in books because we want to have them look nice, maybe let our friends borrow them and such, but I agree with Adler. If you're going to own this book, if you're going to like really make it your own, the contents of this book, if you're really going to get in touch with it and master it, you have to mark it up. I think so. But, you know, again, you can also just do the paper method on the side, okay, and then just make a note of which page you're taking notes from. But I don't know. Something about writing in the books themselves is very liberating to me. So I encourage you to try it. Adler also has a sort of set of symbols, a symbol system that you can use for marking books that you can take a look at as well. I kind of do my own thing, but I just haven't had time to check out Adler's system. But I encourage you to check his out. So yeah, taking notes. It also helps you to remember things. So if you're just taking notes of a short essay, you know, these notes are going to help you remember some of the points that you might have forgotten by the time you got to the end. You know, things like that. It just helps you form the cognitive structure of the presentation, the arrangement of ideas. Okay, on to the next section, coming to terms.
Mortimer, the first thing that a good reader does when he approaches a book is to come to terms with the author. Isn't that right?
There's a reason for it. Authors often use the key words in their writing with very special meanings. And unless the reader notes what those special meanings are, he will not understand what the author's trying to say. It's impossible. Most words in the dictionary are ambiguous. They have many meanings. And many words are used in common speech in one way and by authors in quite a different way. And so the reader's task is to find out precisely the meaning with which the author is using an important word in his text. And the author often calls attention to what he's doing. Mm-hmm. For example, let me give you an example from Thomas Hobbes, a book called The Leviathan, a book in political philosophy written in the 17th century.
Leviathan, the title is not a term.
That was Hobbes' way of referring to the state as a great mammoth.
Right.
And the words in this case are very familiar words, words that you and I and everybody else use every day, war and peace. And when you think about how we use war, we pick up of a war going on when men are fighting one another, bombs are being dropped, cities are being destroyed.
And peace is when that's not going on.
And that's not going on. But Hobbes says no. Or he calls your attention to the fact that there's another meaning for the word. He says, during the time, men live without a common power to keep them all in awe under government. They are in that condition which is called war. For war consists not in battle only. Now, that not as effective.
Right.
Most of us think that war consists in battle or fighting or in the act of fighting. But an attractive time, a period of time, wherein the will to contend by battle is sufficiently known. And therefore, the notion of time is to be considered in the nature of war as it is in the nature of weather. For as the nature of foul weather lies not in a shower or two of rain, but in an inclination thereto of many days together, so the nature of war consists not in actual fighting, but in the known disposition thereto, during all the time there is no assurance to the contrary.
Right.
I want you to notice all of the time is peace, says Hobbes. But what Hobbes is doing here in the 17th century is calling our attention to a meaning of war that we have only come recently to give a name to. We call it the Cold War.
Right.
Men are not actually fighting, but are disposed to fight, are on edge with one another, and would fight if the conditions changed and required it.
And in the Middle East, there's been a condition of either cold or hot war going on for 25 years. And Hobbes would say that's war all the way through.
Now, the meaning of peace is a little... He really always defines war and says all other time is peace.
Right.
But notice, what he means by peace, then, is civil peace. The kind of peace that exists in the United States, in California, in Illinois, in Chicago, in New York, where people are living under government, where they can settle their differences by recourse to law, by recourse to government rather than to fighting.
So even if they are fighting with one another in one way or another, that's...
Contending.
They're contending, but in a condition of peace.
Without resort to force or violence.
Right, right.
That is the meaning of peace.
Right.
Not just the absence of fighting, but the ability to settle differences without recourse to fighting.
Now, is Hobbes consistent throughout the Leviathan in using the words war and peace in that way?
Yes, he is indeed.
That's not true, of course, of all authors, even of authors of great books. Dante in the Divine Comedy, I think that war and peace are two of the really critical terms for Hobbes in the Leviathan. In the Divine Comedy, the critical word is love. The whole of the Divine Comedy consists of 100 cantos, and the very central two, 50 and 51 out of the 100, are a definition of love. Dante not only uses the word in practically every canto,
a description
of love. Dante says to Virgil, "What is love?" And Virgil replies, "This is what love is." Although it's a little bit ambiguous even there, but certainly he's pointing to the importance of this term. But you could just as well discover that love changes its meaning throughout the poem by reading it straight through and discovering, for example, in the fifth canto of the Inferno, in hell, that Francesca is there in hell because of her love. Her love is wrongly directed. It is a love that tends toward lust. Now, when you come to the purgatory, you find another lady, La Pia, who is in purgatory because of her love. It's different from Francesca's love. It is transitory. No. It is not permanent. She only had it for a moment just before she died. And then finally you come in heaven to another famous lady, Picarda, who has still another kind of love. This one is incomplete. It's lukewarm. It is not sufficient, but it is rightly directed, and it was rightly directed throughout her life, so she is in heaven. But she's in a lower level of heaven.
So love is not a single term in Dante. It's a whole series of
terms. It's a whole series. It has a whole series of meanings.
And the reader, the good reader of Dante, must play up and down that series of terms.
And follow Dante along as though he were chasing a rabbit to catch him as he changes.
Now, Hobbes doesn't say definition.
Mm-hmm.
He just introduces it by saying war does not consist in battle only or in the act of fighting. And you know has a special meaning of war. Now, Aristotle, in a book on physics, which is concerned with motion, when he gets to saying exactly what motion is, puts the word definition down. So you know wants you to come to terms with them here. And it's not an easy definition. He says that motion is the actualization of what exists potentially insofar as it exists potentially. Now, that's not easy. But let me just explain that for a moment. Let me take this pen, and I roll it across the table. It started out being here at rest. I push it. Now it's at rest again. But while it was in motion, it was an actualization of its being in the next place, while it still has potentiality for going on to the next place until it stops, and then it's completely actually there and no longer in motion.
Right.
Now, in addition to his defining motion in that very special way, the actualization of a potency while it's still in potency.
Those are tough words.
They are indeed. He also calls our attention to the fact that he's using motion in a way that we don't use in ordinary speech. He says, motion includes, I mean the word motion to cover, alteration, mm-hmm. the changing of an apple from, or leaf from green to red mm-hmm. as the autumn comes on, or increase and decrease, the blowing up of a balloon, getting larger in size, or coming to be and passing away, mm-hmm. a child being born or an animal dying. And only one of the meanings is local motion,
right.
or this kind of motion
which
here.
Which is what we ordinarily think of motion
change.
As being. Right.
Well, we ordinarily use the word change for those four kinds of things and use
right.
motion for one of them. But he says, I'm going to use the word motion for all four. And unless you do that, you aren't paying attention to what Aristotle means, and you haven't come to terms with him,
right.
and you won't understand this text.
Actually, you don't have to agree with his meaning. It doesn't matter whether you think he's right in the word that in the meaning that he gives to the word, but if you... agreeing or not, you have to follow him the way he goes.
Well, unless
otherwise,
you know what his meaning is, you can't tell whether he's right or wrong.
That's right. You're not reading the book. And the book, Physics, the physics of Aristotle, is about nature. Physics means nature,
yeah.
doesn't it? And nature is the realm in which things change.
Yeah.
The play King Lear of Shakespeare is also about nature. It's often been pointed out by good readers of that play that that's a word that's used about 60 or 70 or 100 times in the course of the play. Its meaning, too, changes. But, of course, Shakespeare is not so explicit in saying to you, as Aristotle is, watch for the changes, see what I'm doing.
But you know, Charles...
Wait a minute, Mark. For example, Lear often talks about nature, his natural children, his unnatural children, their unnatural actions toward him, their persecution of him, and so forth. And there he's referring to human nature. But in the third act, at the beginning of the third act, Lear is subjected to the persecution of the heavens when the terrible storm on the heath comes, and that's external nature. Now, the word is not used. Shakespeare doesn't use the word to refer to nature, but we know that that's another meaning of nature which is put into the play.
But poets are at the one extreme of the spectrum. The opposite extreme is that of the mathematician. I mean, here's Shakespeare playing up and down the scale on that word nature,
right.
but when you read Euclid's Elements of Geometry, you have no doubt what he means, because he starts the book off by saying definitions. The opening page is definitions, and there are, in this case, 23 of them.
Mm-hmm.
He starts out by saying, a point is that which has no part. A line is a breadthless length. Then he comes to a definition of a straight line, which we learned in school was the shortest distance between two points. But he says, a straight line is a line which lies evenly with the points on itself, as if you looked along then, you see that the points didn't get off the line.
Right.
Now, mathematicians write that way. Newton writes that way, too. He opens the great work in natural philosophy with a set of definitions. And there, when the term is defined, the author sticks to it throughout the text, and you have very little difficulty coming to terms with him.
Mathematics is hard to read for other reasons, but it's easy to read.
In that sense.
In this sense, because the author does stick with his meaning. Of course, I don't prefer it. I prefer an author to challenge me with unannounced and unidentified changes of meanings. That's why I like poetry so much, because I have to follow the author. You probably prefer the mathematical or philosophical style of writing, don't you?
I do indeed. But in either case, we have the problem of reading is the problem of overcoming the difficulties of language.
Yeah.
See, if language were like a pane of glass through which a beam of light passed, and if... But when you spoke and I listened, or you wrote and I read, the words passed from you to me, carrying their meanings clearly, there'd be no art in reading at all.
Yeah.
But language is not that kind of pane of glass, that translucent medium. It's a barrier. It's a wall. It's a mountain. It stands between you and me. The words don't come through clearly. I must tunnel through as you're trying to tunnel through to me, and only when, using the engineering analogy, the two tunnelings meet do we communicate. And have I come to terms with you and you with me?
And, of course, very often, as you're tunneling through, You hope it doesn't happen engineering, but you miss.
That's right.
You miss, and then you have failed to communicate.
That's exactly what happens.
And you have failed to have something common between you and the author.
It happens most of the time, as a matter of fact.
Many times, a term in a work is not just a single word.
No, it can be a phrase.
Yeah.
For example, in the Declaration of Independence, that marvelous phrase, the consent of the governed, mm-hmm. in Darwin's Origin of Species, survival of the fittest, or the
struggle for existence.
Struggle for
right?
existence.
Or in the case of Kant, that phrase that everybody likes so much, the thing in itself.
Ding an sich.
The Ding an sich, yeah. Now, how do you find these, Mortimer?
Sometimes the author calls attention, as Euclid does, or even Aristotle by saying definition. Sometimes the way Hobbes does it by saying, bringing you up sharp by saying, war does not consist in battle only or in the act of fighting. Then you know he's got a, since you think, you come to the book thinking that's what war does consist in, you realize he's saying something different.
Right.
But sometimes it's not nearly so clear.
Well,
sometimes you have to search it out.
Sometimes you find a term in a work by being puzzled by it. If a word is repeated over and over again and you don't quite know what it means, then probably that's a term of the author. It might be just a name of something that you didn't recognize. That wouldn't be so important. But if it's a term, if it's a word that seems to be repeated over and over again in the author's discourse, and you don't quite get it, then you better find it or you're going to lose
Precisely.
The book as a whole. And the way to find it, of course, is to read around it, isn't it?
Context often helps.
Yes, the context will help. You use other words that you do understand to recognize the meaning of the words you don't understand.
When I mark a book, I usually try to spot those words and mark those words first of all, either by encircling them or underlying them. I sometimes make a list of them because I know that unless I really find out what the author means by those particular words or phrases, I will not have come to terms with them, I will not have understood them, and the act of communication will have failed.
All right, the trivium skill of coming to terms. Now, first, I want to remind you of something, that these skills, while we are they're being presented to you in the format of using them for reading purposes, okay? But I want you to keep in mind that these skills also apply to your everyday life and conversation. Whereas maybe taking notes doesn't really apply to a conversational situation, certainly the skill of coming to terms does. And also, the first one, the distinction of the qualities of materials. Distinguish the qualities of conversation you're having, you know? Are you just having all conversations that are informative and entertaining? How many conversations per day or per week are you having that are uplifting, that are mentally challenging, that lead you from understanding less to understanding more, okay? So always keep that in mind. These skills, I mean, you just get them embedded in your mind and you will use them in many, many, many different situations, okay? So coming to terms, very huge. This is crucial to the grammar stage of the trivia method, all right? This is where you're starting to acquire basic information. What does this author mean by love or hate or war or peace? You know, it seems he uses it in many different senses. So what does he mean when he uses it here and when he uses it here? You know, the very crucial thing to do, because if you don't know what they mean by the words they are using, you cannot possibly understand what they are writing, what they are saying to you. It's just not possible at all. A clear example of the need to define terms is in the legal language. Some call it legalese. I like that. If you're reading a legal document, you have to define all of those terms by the legal definitions, which are not the same as the common dictionary definitions. And if you do not define those terms in such a manner, you will not at all understand what is being presented and represented by this law. Okay? So it's very crucial in life, in reading, and in conversation that we define our terms. And that's kind of hard to do in conversation because, well, in my experience, it's been difficult because when I ask somebody, what do you mean by that? It can very often lead to the realization that the person doesn't realize or they don't know what they meant. It was more just of an unemotive use of language. It wasn't really a rational use of language. And that's upsetting for many people. And this I do this to myself as well. I'll be talking to someone and I'll say, well, what did I mean by that? And then I dig a little bit deeper and I realize, well, I meant this, that, and the other thing, but I didn't really mean what that word is meant to represent, you know? And so it's challenging to the ego, but I'll tell you what, right now, the entire path of liberal education is challenging to the ego because you are discovering not only the flaws in thinking in other people, but the flaws in thinking in yourself. And you're also seeing, you know, where you stand as a thinker, how well your mind is already put together and how much work you still have to do. And for some people, that is a bit crushing to their sense of, importance or intelligence or whatever. I just encounter this a lot, so I'm giving you a fair warning. Get ready to find your weaknesses and your flaws, but to improve them. And that's what this is all about. Finding these weaknesses and flaws and improving them. And by that, we all benefit. We become better. We create a better society together, okay? So just realize, you know, sometimes you just have to set your ego down and do the hard work. All right, so coming to terms, check it out. Trivium skill number 3, okay? Let's move on to the next one. This one happens to be my personal favorite, and that is the paraphrase.
Mortimer, I'm going to play a game with you. You play it with me. I'm going to give you a sentence and ask you to state its meaning in your own words.
Right.
And then you do the same to me. This is a statement that Hamlet makes to Horatio in the play Hamlet. Very famous quote, but often misunderstood. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
I would say that Hamlet is saying, your understanding of the world, Horatio, is not adequate. There are more things than you understand.
In other words, you're emphasizing the word your.
Yes, your, Horatio's philosophy.
No, it isn't that.
Oh, I see.
There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Oh, he might have said, there are more things in heaven and earth than philosophers can understand.
That's right, because there are ghosts and spirits and things like that.
Your isn't the personal your.
And philosophy means material philosophy. It means, because Hamlet is throughout that play a materialist.
I see.
As you'll see in a moment.
Well, let me try you on one then. In the Middle Ages, the great theologians and the philosophers were very fond of saying again and again, nothing acts except it is actual. What's that mean to you? Say that in your own words now. Nothing acts except it is actual.
It means I can't be hurt by something that is only potential. Unless something actually is, it can't hurt me.
That's something exists, it can't hurt you. Now, give me an example of what. Show me that you understand that by giving me a concrete example of something that can't hurt you because it isn't actual.
Well, a possible thunderstorm can't wet me.
Precisely. Next little sentence I'd like to try you on is one of my favorite sentences in Rousseau's Social Contract, where he's referring back to Aristotle's doctrine that some men are by nature slaves. And he says, refers to Aristotle's doctrine, and then he says, about that doctrine, that some men are by nature slaves, Aristotle was right, but he took the effect for the cause.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That is to say, he thought, because men act like slaves,
slavishly,
therefore they really are slaves, whereas what Rousseau meant was, because they're treated like slaves, they then act like slaves.
In other words, he's charging Aristotle with having confused nature and nurture.
Right.
Aristotle should not have said some men are by nature slaves,
right,
but some men are by nurture slaves.
Yeah, that's very good. That's a better way to do it. Finally, two sentences from Hamlet, but they come right together. Hamlet's last words to Horatio, the rest is silence. Hamlet dies. Horatio says, good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. And beautiful, beautiful statement. But can you elucidate the two sentences?
Well, Hamlet is saying, when I'm dead, I'm dead.
Yeah.
No more.
Right.
And Horatio is saying, oh no, sweet prince, there's another world to which you will be escorted by angels.
Yeah, it's kind of not fair because Hamlet is dead and can no longer argue.
Answer.
But in fact, that argument between Hamlet and Horatio runs throughout the play. Yeah. Hamlet is a materialist. Horatio is a Christian.
Yeah.
And who believes in the immortality of the soul. And if you don't catch those key sentences, you don't see the metaphysical argument and the religious argument that's going on throughout the play.
I have one more sentence from you, for you rather. It's from Machiavelli. There are two ways of contesting, of quarreling, differing. Mm-hmm. There are two ways of contesting, the one by law, the other by force. The first method is proper to men, the second to beasts. But because the first is frequently not sufficient, it is necessary to have recourse to the second. Therefore, it is necessary for a prince to understand how to avail himself of the beast and of the man.
And that's a terrible statement, isn't it? It means that we, in the war of life, which we all live, we cannot afford to be wholly human. We also have to be bestial. And what we're doing here, of course, we first have to find, and then elucidate in our own words, the key sentences in a book. If we don't do that, we're going to not be able to capture the author's meaning.
I think, particularly in expository books, the author helps us to find his key sentences, yeah. And our job is not to find them, but to understand them. I think more often, in the books you've been referring to, in the poetical books, it is more difficult. The author doesn't underline the sentence for you. For example, I have a book here which is a recent publication, a book about the environmental crisis, very good book indeed, by Barry Commoner, called The Closing Circle. And Commoner does it. He does it by, look, Charles, he does it by putting right in the center of the page the first law, the second law.
Right.
Let me read you the four laws. Everything is connected to everything else is the first law.
Right.
And the second one is everything must go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is nature knows best. And the fourth one is there is no such thing as a free lunch. Now, again, the reader can't possibly miss the sentences.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not enough. In fact, they're elliptical. They're tantalizing. What does he mean by everything? There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
As a basic law of nature.
Yeah, and part of the pointing to the key sentence on the part of the author is this tantalizing quality.
Precisely.
Yeah, he wants to engage your attention to make you ask a question and wonder what he means.
And I think it's very successful because since you are caught, perplexed by those mm-hmm. elliptical and enigmatic sentences, you then read very carefully to find out why he says there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
Other authors do it somewhat differently. For example, in the Middle Ages, one of the great works in the 13th century is Aquinas's Summa Theologica, which is voluminous. And yet it's divided into hundreds and hundreds of questions. And each question being asked, the author points out his answer. He always begins by giving you the wrong answer first.
Right.
Say, objection one, objection two, and that signals that he's giving you the wrong answer. And then when he finishes with the wrong answers, he says, on the contrary, I answer that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can't miss his sentence because he said, now, having told you what the wrong answers are, I'm going to see what the right answer is, and he lays it out. But again, finding the key sentence in this case is easy because the author's helped you to find it. Then the challenge to you or the task for you is to understand it. And what we did at the beginning then, that little game we played, I think illustrates what must be done to understand it. You've got to... let me go back a moment and say something else, Charles. I used to give oral examinations at St. John's in Chicago. And one of the reasons why an oral examination is so much better than a written examination is the professor can never, in a written examination, say to the student, what did you mean by these words? But in an oral examination, the student often repeats words he's read in a book. And you say, now, Mr. Jones, what you just said is exactly what Hobbes said or what Darwin or Locke said. Now tell me in your own words what Locke or Hobbes or Darwin meant.
Mm-hmm.
And then the student who's remembered the words perfectly can't tell you in his own words.
No.
And you know he hasn't understood the sentence.
Right, he's just memorized.
Or sometimes he actually can do it. And then you say, that's very good, Mr. Jones, but now give me a concrete example of it.
Yeah.
And he fails to do that. Now, those are the two tests I've always used to be sure the student really grasped the meaning of the key sentence.
You talk about students, but this is, in fact, what every reader, every good reader, has to do.
All of my students, by the way, are readers.
Yeah.
Well, they wouldn't be students unless they were.
A student is a reader.
Yeah.
The examples you've been giving there, and this kind of test, is particularly good for expository works, works of philosophy, mm-hmm. history, and so forth. But poets, dramatists, have different ways of pointing out the key sentences or the key statements in their works. In Macbeth, for example... There's a marvelous interchange. My father always used to remind me of this. King Duncan comes in, and he's just had to execute the Thane of Cawdor, who was a traitor. And he says of him, "There's no art to tell the mind's construction in the face. He was a gentleman on whom I built an absolute trust." That's a nice statement. He's expressing his regret about the treachery of the previous Thane of Cawdor. Yeah. The next statement in the play is, "Enter Macbeth." And, in fact, Macbeth enters upon that line. That's his entrance line. And, well, of course, within 24 hours, he has murdered Duncan himself. He was a man in whom Duncan had an absolute trust, but a man who betrayed him much more terribly than the Thane of Cawdor ever did.
The sentence is a dramatic confrontation.
Right. And you understand that that's what the play is really about.
Sure.
Because Macbeth, at the beginning of that play, is a man in whom one can have an absolute trust. But the corruption of Macbeth, the lessening of his trustworthiness, is the course of the action. Now, a lyric poet does this even differently. He does not have the device of dramatic action, so he has to do it in words. And the sound of words becomes very important. There's a famous example in Milton's Lycidas, which, among other things... Yeah, everybody read it in high school, but not everybody reads it as carefully as he should. Among other things, this poem is about the clergy. The corrupt clergy on the one hand, and the honest and a devout clergy on the other hand, because Lycidas stands for a friend. This is a poem about a friend of Milton's who died when he was very young, and he would have been a good clergyman instead of a bad one. And in referring to the bad ones, Milton talks about their sermons. And he talks about the way the people listen. And when they list, their lean and flashy songs, that is, of the corrupt clergy, grate on their scrannel pipes of wretched straw. And
grate, G-R-A-T-E?
Yeah, as though you were grating cheese. Yeah. And the noise, the sound, the words that they say grate on their minds, and they are of no worth to them. On the other hand, when Milton finally talks about Lycidas himself, who is his friend, he says, and when he goes to heaven, he will hear the unexpressive nuptial song in the blessed kingdoms meek of joy and love. There entertain him all the saints above in solemn troops and sweet societies. And the difference in sound between in solemn troops and sweet societies
and great
on their scrannel pipes of wretched straw.
That's an expression, a hard word. On their scrannel pipes.
Nobody knows quite what that word means. He may have even made up the
word.
But
the sound is, you're quite right. Contrasting sounds, they do it.
The contrasting sounds indicate the contrasting moral conditions. And if you don't get that contrast, if you don't catch it, you have not really understood one of the main themes of Lycidas.
You know, Charles, this attention we've been paying here to sentences is secondary in a sense, because the first thing you have to do is catch the important words.
Yeah, come to terms.
Yeah. And those important words often occur in the important sentences. In the case of the words, it's really getting their meaning. In the case of the sentences, understanding what's being said. And so that you've got a second level of interpretation here.
Right.
Words or terms, sentences, propositions, really.
Right.
And then, of course, there's still a third level, namely the level of the sequence of sentences, the sentences in the book that put together, hanging together in a sequence, form a whole coherent argument, whether it be a book of poetry or an expository book.
Right. And if you fail to do that, if you fail to identify the terms and then the key sentences and then put them
together
in a sequence, you have failed really to understand the book.
All right, so the paraphrase. Essential trivium skill. This is one that you can start applying right away and make very great use of. This is one that I think really helps build that intellectual muscle. But you have to start small. You have to start where you're at. And if you're like me, your mind is a mess, and your abilities of paraphrasing are going to be very minimal at first. But you stick to it. You apply this stuff daily, if possible. And you're going to see improvement. You're going to see improvement in your ability to speak and in your ability to think, to arrange your thoughts. So yes, the paraphrase is a huge, huge skill. You can start right now, actually. You don't have to go any further in the presentation than this explanation of an exercise for using the paraphrase. Go back to any section in this presentation, okay? There's many, many different sections in the first half and then in what you've heard so far in the second. And then paraphrase in one sentence that entire section. So perhaps the section in which I describe the trivium method, okay, or the example I use of using the trivium method. go ahead and paraphrase either of those sections into one sentence. It could be a short sentence, a long sentence, no matter. Paraphrase it into one sentence. Then, after doing that, paraphrase it into three sentences. Okay? More challenging. Each is challenging. It's challenging just to keep it down to one sentence, but then to say, well, now I'm going to say it in a completely different way with the same ideas represented in three sentences. You know, and you could do this with anything. Pick anything. Open up a book. Take a paragraph and paraphrase it. A conversation you had with a friend at work yesterday. Paraphrase that whole conversation. You know, paraphrase your day. Just use this skill. Because when you start reading, like, the great books, for instance, you're going to want to have some real ability with it already, as much as possible. I mean, give yourself the advantage. You know, that's what I'm doing here by presenting these trivium skills, is trying to give you these advantages that aren't necessarily outlined for you when you're encountering other trivium material. All right? Now, there's two examples that I want to leave you with of people who have attributed their intellectual development and ability to speak with the use of the paraphrase. Not just the paraphrase, but it's somewhat of a highlight. These two people, Benjamin Franklin and Abraham Lincoln, very large figures in American history. So we'll start with Abraham Lincoln. This passage comes from the book How to Talk, Meeting the Situations of Personal and Business Life and of Public Address by Clapp and Kane. This is definitely part of your suggested reading list, and I highly encourage you to get a copy of How to Talk by Clapp and Kane for yourself. Now, this comes from chapter 1, page 7, the heading How Lincoln Did It. From his early youth, Abraham Lincoln took assiduous pains to master the powers of language. Some commentators go so far as to say that he owed his political eminence to his unremitting effort to use his mother tongue skillfully and persuasively. There is at least one remark of his own on the matter that has been carefully recorded. After the Cooper Union address in 1860, Lincoln left New York in company with an elderly acquaintance who asked him this question, quote, "I want very much to know how you got this unusual power of putting things. It must have been a matter of education. No man has it by nature alone. What has your education been?" End quote. Lincoln answered, "Well, as to education, the newspapers are correct. I never went to school more than 6 months of my life. But as you say, this must be a product of culture in some form. I've been putting the question you ask me to myself while you have been talking. I say this, that among my earliest recollections, I remember now when a mere child, I used to get irritated when anybody talked to me in a way I could not understand. I don't think I ever got angry at anything else in my life, but that always disturbed my temper and has ever since. I can remember going to my little bedroom after hearing the neighbors talk of an evening with my father and spending no small part of the night walking up and down and trying to make out the exact meaning of some of their, to me, dark sayings. I could not sleep, though I often tried to, when I got in such a hunt after an idea, until I caught it. And when I thought I had got it, I was not satisfied until I had repeated it over and over, until I had put it in language plain enough, as I thought, for any boy I knew to comprehend. This was a kind of passion with me, and it has stuck by me, for I am never easy now when I am handling a thought till I have bounded it north and bounded it south and bounded it east and bounded it west. Perhaps that accounts for the characteristics you observe in my speeches, though I never put the two things together before." So there, right there, Lincoln was just going off on his own, being baffled by some statements of the grown-ups around him, and working alone by himself diligently to make sense of what was being said, and not only to understand the basic concepts being expressed, but to be able to re-express those concepts, or to express those concepts in his own language, in a simple language, enough that he could explain it to his friends, other small children. Very, very amazing that he just went off and did this on his own. See, we all have some of these impulses to use some of these, what I'm calling trivium skills, but really these just seem to be potential functions of our minds. And many of us get these intuitions to start thinking and doing things in these certain ways, although we don't always have the courage to fully pursue it or don't understand the context or the value. Myself, for instance, I've definitely found myself using some of these trivium skills, but not really fully pursuing it, not seeing it as part of a bigger picture of learning to use my mind. And oftentimes by using these skills, you know, simply and one at a time, I found myself perplexed by the enormity of things I did not know. So I don't have that problem anymore, even though what I do not know becomes such a larger sphere all the time. I'm not perplexed by it. I'm not afraid of it. I'm fully capable of moving in any direction, north, east, south, or west, with this information. So, yeah, this stuff is, in many ways, this material, these skills, this method, this is an innate function of the human mind. And what we're doing is bringing this out into the light of day for you so you can see it. You can see what you didn't already have going on inside of you and get that going. You can see what you had going on inside of you and make it better. And then you can have this so explicitly, you can pass it on to others. So, yeah, it's all part of the fun of the free education in the 21st century. Okay, so the paraphrase. One more little passage from Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, another great book to have. And here he's talking about his youth. And he goes on to say, this is from page 11. About this time, I met with an odd volume of The Spectator. It was the third. I had never before seen any of them. I bought it, read it over and over, and was much delighted with it. I thought the writing excellent and wished, if possible, to imitate it. With this view, I took some of the papers and, making short hints of the sentiment in each sentence, taking notes, laid them by a few days, and then, without looking at the book, tried to complete the papers again by expressing each hinted sentiment at length and as fully as that had been expressed before in any suitable words that should come to hand. Then I compared my Spectator with the original, discovered some of my faults, and corrected them. But I found I wanted a stock of words or a readiness in recollecting and using them which I thought I should have acquired before that time if I had gone on making verses, since the continual occasion for words of the same import but of different length to suit the measure or of different sound for the rhyme would have laid me under a constant necessity of searching for variety and also have tended to fix that variety in my mind and make me master of it. Therefore, I took some of the tales and turned them into verse, and after a time, when I had pretty well forgotten the prose, turned them back again. I also sometimes jumbled my collection of hints into confusion, and after some weeks endeavored to reduce them into the best order before I began to form the full sentences and complete the paper. This was to teach me method in the arrangement of thoughts. By comparing my work afterwards with the original, I discovered many faults and amended them. But I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that, in certain particulars of small import, I had been lucky enough to improve the method or the language, and this encouraged me to think I might possibly in time come to be a tolerable English writer, of which I was extremely ambitious. My time for these exercises and for reading was at night, after work, or before it began in the morning, or on Sundays, when I contrived to be in the printing house alone, evading as much as I could the common attendance on public worship which my father used to exact of me when I was under his care, and which, indeed, I still thought a duty, though I could not, as it seemed to me, afford time to practice it. So there you go, young Benjamin Franklin ditching church to start learning, huh? Interesting. So that right there, he highlights a few trivium skills there, taking notes and the paraphrase. And his method of paraphrase is huge, okay? This is great stuff. Take a written piece, you know, whether it be a news article or a part of an essay or something, and take the notes. A few days later, come back to it and try and reproduce it as well as you can. See, you know, by comparing to the original, see where you have done well and where you haven't, and improve it by that. And then also translating something from you know, poetry into plain writing, okay? So from verse into prose, and then back again after a time. That's great stuff. I can't remember who it was. Some writer, I think it might have been one of the early grammarians or something, who translated from his original language into English, and then after, you know, spending many years doing that, translated his English version back into Latin without referring to the original, and then comparing that Latin translation with the original to see how well he did. So if you know more than one language, you really can make use of the paraphrase in this manner by translating from one language to another, but also translating from poetry into prose, that's, and then back again. I mean, huge stuff. So this Trivium skill in particular, I like to highlight because it just seems that so much benefit comes of it and incorporates so much of your mental ability and your use of language. This is going to get you going to the thesaurus, to the dictionary. This is going to get you really working hard. And you're going to start to do it all the time when you're listening to people. You might just repeat back to them what they just said, but in a different way. And that really helps the conversation because then they can say, yeah, you totally get what I'm saying. You just said to me what I said, but in a different way. You get it, man. You know, that's great stuff. We want to go for understanding, not just in ourselves when we're reading, but with other people in our lives. Okay, our culture is a mess. And by our culture, I'm not just talking about America, the West, the East, the world, you know. There is not this huge push to come to greater understanding and peace. And we can do this through education, or at least we can do this in part through education, okay? So we seek for understanding with others. And by understanding what they say and demonstrating that through the use of the paraphrase, we really can accomplish this goal. And I like how Adler and Van Doren were playing that little game, and they say, okay, tell me, you know, what I'm basically saying here, and then give a concrete example. Whew, that's tough. I falter with that one so much. So I'm hoping that in 6 months' time, some of you hearing this presentation will start using these skills daily and come to me and teach me a few things. You know what I'm saying? Because I just don't have much time to use it. But again, I use it enough that I've seen gains. I've improved my mind to some extent by just, you know, small applications of these skills. So I think that should be a bit of a hint, a nudge, and a bit of hope for anybody who's thinking perhaps that they won't have the time to make use of this stuff. All right, I think that's about it for this section. Let's move on to the next Trivium skill, finding the argument. This one's a bit more subtle, but it's just as important as all the others, if not more so. I'll see you on the other side.
Sometimes, Charles, an author doesn't mark his sentences for you the way the commoner does by putting the sentence at the center of the page and saying, this is the important sentence. A very difficult book indeed to read is Rousseau's Social Contract because it's very tightly written.
And with enormous style.
Yeah. But you've got to find his key sentences. I've read this book a good many times, I would guess.
How many times?
I would guess in the last 50 years, 20, 25 times. And over the years of reading it, I think I've found the key sentences which, if you put them together, as you must put them together, make the argument for book one of the Social Contract. Let me read you what I've picked out as the key sentences in that first book. The first one is the opening sentence of chapter 2. The most ancient of all societies, and the only, emphasize the word only, one that is natural, is the family. And even so, the children remain attached to the father only so long as they need him for their preservation.
Yeah.
Now, when they grow up, the family is dissolved. That,
the key words are only natural and need.
That's right.
Right.
Now, the second sentence, which occurs as the opening sentence of chapter 3, makes a different point. But these two sentences then carry on into the third, fourth, and fifth sentence. Second sentence of importance is, the strongest is never strong enough to be always the master unless he transforms strength into right and obedience into duty.
Right in the sense of lawfulness, or legitimacy,
legitimate authority.
Right.
And that point is carried off into the next key sentence, which is the opening sentence of chapter 4. Let's do it carefully now. Since no man has a natural authority over his fellow.
A natural authority, yeah. Right.
By nature, doesn't have authority over another man. Mm-hmm. And since force creates no right, we must conclude that conventions form the basis of all legitimate authority among men.
Because force does not create a lawfulness or a legitimate authority. Right, okay.
And finally, the last two sentences. He has supposed that men are living in a state of nature, not in a state of civil society. And he says, I suppose men to have reached the point at which the obstacles in the way of their preservation in the state of nature show their power of resistance to be greater than the resources at the disposal of each individual for his maintenance in that state. Mm-hmm. That primitive condition can thus subsist no longer.
That is, they can't live in the state of nature
right.
anymore because they'll die.
And the human race would perish
right.
unless it changed its manner of existence. Well, now, if we go back to the first sentence, mm-hmm. which makes the family natural because we need it for our preservation, then the state
right.
is equally natural, is it not?
Right. Because we need it. Right.
Now, okay. having put those, the state being natural, but force creating no right, the last sentence of these five states the problem we have to solve. The problem, says Rousseau, is to find a form of association which will defend and protect with the whole common force the person and goods of each associate, and in which each, you and I joining together, mm-hmm. all of us forming a state, in which each, while uniting himself with all, may still obey himself alone and remain as free as before.
Yeah.
Now, how he solves that problem is of course, the...
Right.
the
But what you've done here is to take a whole book. It's a book out of... It's several pages long,
yes.
10 pages long.
That's right.
And you have found the key sentences which added up make the argument of
book one.
Of book one, yeah. It's a very hard thing to do, Mortimer. It's probably very hard to follow it as you read it. I mean, you should have the text in front of you, but you have to make the effort to do it, don't you?
Yes, because if you don't do that, you're just reading page after page with no build-up of argument.
Right.
Now, you know, Charles, sometimes in this task of finding the author's important sentences, you come upon a quite different situation. That is, the examples we've had so far are examples where the sentences build up constructively, cumulatively, to make an argument to which each sentence contributes. But sometimes, when you read a book, you find sentences that puzzle you because, within a few pages, what is said in one sentence appears to be contradicted by what is said in another. Let me... Mm-hmm. I'm one of my... this is an extraordinary document, by the way. This
well,
is the
what is it?
Preamble of the Mechanics' Union of Trade Associations in 1827 in Philadelphia.
Oh, yes,
one of the
right.
earliest
yeah.
papers of a labor union. And the mechanics say, it's written almost in the tone of the Declaration of Independence, on the first of these pages, "Do not all the streams of wealth which flow in every direction and are emptied into and absorbed by the coffers of the unproductive, that is, the capitalists, the owners
yeah.
of, exclusively take their rise in the bones, marrow, and muscles of the industrious classes."
Right. Okay.
They're saying, yes, labor is the sole producer of wealth.
Right.
Now then, having said that, one page later they said, "No, at the present period, when wealth is so easily and abundantly created that the markets of the world are overflowing with it, and when, in consequence thereof, and of the continual development increase of scientific power and technology, the demand for human labor is gradually and inevitably diminishing." Mm-hmm. Just listen to that. Mm-hmm. Here they've said, "Is not labor the sole source of wealth?" Mm-hmm. And a page later they say, "Because of modern technology..."
Yeah, the technology is
increasing,
is
and
a
labor is being less in demand. Well,
right.
both of those can't be true.
Right.
Now, the great advantage, I always like to emphasize this point, of finding a contradiction like that.
Yeah, what do you do when you find
well,
it?
Well, what's wonderful
you
is...
You throw the book away?
No, on the contrary. You just hold it to your breast and say, one of those two things must be true. They both can't be true.
Well, they can't both be true. Could they both be false?
Yes, this is not a strict...
If they're a strict contradiction,
yeah.
one of them has to be false yeah. and the other true.
But these both can't be true.
Right.
And so you're asking yourself, which is true if either is true?
Right.
And then still within the ambit of a few pages, within our second page, they go on to say, "It is neither our intention nor desire to extort inequitable prices for our labor. All we demand is a full and fair equivalent, mm-hmm. our share."
Yeah.
But they said at
yeah.
the beginning that we are the sole producers of wealth. They should have all of it.
They should have it all.
This is a book by Jacob Bernofsky. It's called The Identity of Man, about man in relation to the rest of nature. And Bernofsky begins by saying that his fundamental assumption that man is a part of nature. And he goes on and says that this means that there's no break in the continuity of nature. Man differs from other things just in a continuum of degrees. Man is simply a little more of the same mm-hmm. as other animals. Then on page 48, having built up that whole argument of the continuity of nature, and he says, "The gift of humanity is precisely that, unlike other animals, we form concepts, Mm-hmm. Well, now,
yeah.
At that point, if we and we alone form concepts,
right.
and no other animal forms concepts, if you, I'm saying which is true, yeah. then we aren't continuous with the rest of nature. There's a difference in kind there.
Right.
Because the difference in kind is a difference between which, of the two things being right. compared, one does something the other doesn't do at all.
This is really a flat contradiction.
Flat
we
contradiction.
Either are different in degree from other animals, or we
kind.
Are different in kind from one another. Oh. And you got to choose.
Yeah.
You have
That's
to
right.
choose. Having you, found the contradiction, you are faced with the task of choosing.
You may not like Mr. Bernowski, but I'm now going to read you from a Nobel Prize winner. I mean, a great scientist. This is George Beadle,
yeah.
who was won the Nobel Prize for genetics. And was chancellor of the university, president of the University of Chicago. And here's a book by George, written with Muriel, his wife, called The Language of Life. And this is even more striking because on page 41, we read about Homo sapiens, our ancestor.
Oh, but that's the species to which we belong, right?
He did not differ from me. Listen this carefully, because he's using the words even more mm-hmm. blatantly. He, Homo sapiens, did not differ from the apes in kind, nor do we. But he differed greatly in degree, as much as our descendants, if the human line survives, may differ from us after an equivalent amount of time has elapsed. That's page 41.
Okay.
On page 39, he says, but with the initial discovery that one can make tools, our species appeared on the evolutionary horizon. Mm-hmm. Apes can use tools, but only men can fabricate them. I'm not saying it's right, but if it's true mm-hmm. that only men can fabricate tools, only men means apes can't fabricate them, and that means there's a difference in kind, not a difference in degree.
Right.
So 2 pages later, he says there's only a difference in degree.
Right.
Now, I really don't. I'm puzzled sometimes. I don't understand how a great scientist like George Beadle,
yeah,
can within 2 pages not know he's contradicted himself.
Are you saying the book's a bad book?
No, no. I'm saying that. It's true of the great books, true of other books. I could show you a case in Aristotle, I think. Let me give you a case in Aristotle without even going to the text. In the Politics, and I think Beadle is better than Bernofsky, and I think Aristotle is better than Beadle.
Right.
But Aristotle will say in chapter 2 of the first book of the Politics, man is by nature a political animal. And then in chapter 4, he will say, some men are by nature slaves. Well, now, both of those things can't be true.
Right.
For if man, meaning all men, mm-hmm. are by nature political, able to participate in government, take part in political life, then some men can't be by nature slaves, incapable of such
right.
political activities.
Right.
And yet, contradiction is the most extraordinary thing, because unless you're the most careful writer in the world, you can, as the context of your discussion changes, say things that are not mm-hmm. in harmony or coherence. But the duty of the reader, I insist, I may be over-exaggerating this, but my own tendency to be logical.
Well, you love to find contradictions.
But if you don't find them, what are you doing with your mind when you read a book? If you
mm-hmm.
don't find them, are you really paying attention to the argument? And in the case of Aristotle, I think you either have to find a way of reconciling those two statements, or you have to say he's wrong about one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Either all men are by nature political, in which case no men are by nature slaves, mm-hmm. or if some men are by nature slaves, then it's not true that all men are by nature political.
Finding contradictions in a book serves another purpose for the reader. When you find a contradiction, you have found a place where the author is really struggling. If he were clear on a subject, he wouldn't contradict himself.
That's entirely correct.
The contradiction identifies a problem that the author is struggling with and trying to solve. And finding the problems that the author is trying to solve in his book tells you what the book is all about.
And sometimes the author does it for you, and sometimes he doesn't.
You mean does what for you?
States
what his problem is.
But I agree with you that whether he does it or not, your task is to find out what the problem is that the author is trying to solve. Now, Rousseau, whom I referred to before, does it beautifully for you in the very opening sentence. I mean, it couldn't be better.
Yeah, I love that sentence.
The opening sentence of The Social Contract. Let me read it to you. He says, these are ringing words, man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains. One thinks himself the master of others, and still remains a greater slave than they. How did this change come about? I do not know. What can make it legitimate? That question, I think I can answer. Well, now, you know.
Yeah.
He says, now, the problem this book is going to solve is how, what makes government, the government of men, legitimate. Mm-hmm. And he says, I think I can answer it. Well, you either find out that he does or doesn't answer it.
Right.
I tend to think he's come very close to answering it, not perfectly, but a very good solution to a very difficult problem.
You have to know what the author was trying to do in order to be able to judge whether he has done it or not.
Right, right.
And this is, of course, the first step in criticism. We are now moving to another phase.
From interpretation to criticism.
Okay, finding the argument. This is similar in some ways to the paraphrase, because, I mean, really, you can use the paraphrase to find somebody's argument, but it is not the paraphrase. All right, finding the argument is figuring out what this author is saying, or what this person is saying. You know, what are they really saying? They're using language and they're making, you know, statements, some that are explicit, some that are implied. Overall, they're presenting an idea to you, or at least trying to. And so your job is to figure out what their argument is. What are they saying? What are they trying to persuade me of? What are they trying to inform me of? And one of the ways to do this is to find in a book the key sentences, as Adler and Van Doren called them. These are the sentences that really tie together all of the rest of the information. All of the other information is only to explain these key sentences. So when you can identify those key sentences in a book, you have gone a very long way into really coming to understand what is being presented to you. Okay? So it's tough work. Now, in conversation or in other things besides reading, it can be a bit difficult because you don't have the time. And the people might not really be talking to you in a way where there are key sentences. You know, conversations can be quite chaotic. Now, there is one skill that is not what I had originally intended to present to you here in this presentation that I'm going to only briefly cover. So you might not fully grasp it right now, but it's something for you to start with. And this comes from the subject of rhetoric, okay? It's called the rhetorical triangle, and that will help you to get in touch with the argument being presented to you. Now, the rhetorical triangle is this. Form this symbol in your mind of a triangle with a circle surrounding it, or some prefer a circle inside of it. It doesn't matter. I prefer the circle outside, okay? So a triangle with a circle inscribing it. I think that's the right geometrical term. Okay, you have 3 points of the triangle. One point is the audience. Another point is the message or the text. And the other point is the author or the speaker. The circle is the context, okay? So you have your audience, your message, and your author, your speaker. So when you're reading a book, you can use the concept of the rhetorical triangle. And again, it's something you want to make more habitual. You don't want to have to spend too much time forming this triangle in your mind. You know, this is just a way of organizing the information, organizing the ability. This is a way of representing a mental function. And this is helping to find the argument. So you have your audience. Now, let's say you're the audience, and it's a chewing gum commercial, and they're using, you know, the Double Mint Twins, okay? Everybody's probably seen that commercial from the 80s and 90s. And basically, you had two attractive blonde twin females, and somehow that was used and was somehow related to this chewing gum. And these commercials were all over the place. You know, double your pleasure, double your fun. So now let's use the rhetorical triangle to discover what is the argument here. You're the audience. The message is these attractive blondes and these great fun scenes, and then they're chewing gum, okay? And the author is this company, the Double Mint Company. The context is that the author, the company, wants your money, and they have a product to give you in order to get that money. And the way they're trying to do that is by crafting their message to you, the audience, in such a way that you give them your money and get their product in return. And obviously, they're making a lot of money off your purchase. So they really want you to get your wallet out and give them the money. But how are they doing that? Well, they're in this instance, you could say, in the instance of the Double Mint Twins commercials, they're using sex to sell. They're not making the argument, this gum is great tasting and you like this kind of flavor. This gum is going to improve you in some way. They're not coming out directly and presenting you with a logical argument. They're not appealing to your mind. They're appealing to your emotions, your sense of sexuality, of pleasure, of fun, okay, of comfort. They're giving you this message of those things and then connecting it to a product that you can buy. So now you feel good about buying this product. And when you go to buy that product, you might not even think of the commercials, but there's just a good feeling attached to the sight of the logo and the pack and the idea of the gum and your experiences chewing it before. So there's the argument. Give us your money. We'll sell you sex to do that. We'll try and bypass your logic and your reasoning in order to give you this product, or not to give this product to you, but to get you to buy this product from us. And so that's the argument of the Wrigley, gum company, is that, well, we have a product to sell you, and the only way we can do that is by deceiving you in some way or undercutting your intelligence and appealing directly to your emotions, okay? So there, that's the rhetorical triangle in a very small, quick nutshell. Go back more into that. The Trivium binder, which I'll talk about later, is going to have some more information on that as well. But that's one technique that comes directly from the Trivium subjects, which helps you with the Trivium skill of finding the argument. Now, finding the argument, again, it's easy for me to call these things Trivium skills and to put them in these little categories and such, but it's something you just want to have invisible in your mind that is always going. You're always looking for what is the argument here. You know, when I watch commercials now, it's so fun because you can see how they present their arguments. And it's interesting. I've found even commercials that the true argument wasn't even to sell the product. It was to sell certain ideas amidst selling this product. It was very, very, very subtle. But now when I read books as well, I want to know what this author is talking about. I don't want to just believe that what he's saying is true and that he's doing a good job of it. It's these skills that I'm presenting to you, you want to incorporate into your life of thought so well that they're always going, and you don't have to spend very much energy using them because they're just there. They're there and they're running. Okay? So go ahead and find the argument. Next up, this last stop on the Trivium Skills Tour, and we're going to switch from Adler and Van Doren to Mr. Reverend Edmund Opitz, and he provided the world with a nice little talk on the liberal arts called The Liberating Arts, Earmarks of a Liberal Education. And I'm selecting just one small part from his whole talk, which discusses the Trivium skill of mental concentration and memorization. All right, so I'll see you on the other side with that. We're switching again from Adler to Opitz. Ciao.
Now for some practical advice, by which I guarantee that you can upgrade your marks. This idea of self-education I came across in sort of a playful way in a book by Arnold Bennett, the well-known British novelist. It's on your list. The pamphlet was written maybe about 1912, called How to Live on 24 Hours a Day. And he constructs a kind of a humorous dialogue between himself and someone who doesn't agree with this when Bennett says, I can change your life. Give me 90 minutes, three evenings a week, and I can transform you. A bit of a humorous dialogue about this, and finally, Bennett convinces this person to give it a try. 90 minutes, three times a week of intense study. Now, this does not mean merely sitting down with a book in front of you. That's where you start. You start picking out some topic, a subject of your own choice. Maybe political economy, one of the books you'll pick up here. Start somewhere. Select some topic for study, get a book, and begin to read. Well, Bennett says, you'll start to read, and after a few minutes, your mind will be in Seattle or in New York or miles away. Grab your mind by the scruff of the neck and bring it back, says Bennett. And gradually, your mind will realize who's in charge and begin to obey you. as soon as it knows that you mean business. At this point, your mind will start to pay attention and do what you demand of it. There's another little gadget I picked up somewhere else. Every evening before retiring, rehearse the events of the day. What was it like outside when you first got out of bed? What did you have for breakfast? What did you do during the day? Whom did you meet? And so on. Now, once your mind realizes that it will be called upon to recite at the end of the day, it'll start paying attention. You'll begin to experience the events of the day more vividly, and you will remember them, or your mind will. Leonard Reed kept a journal, and this is an extra little chore added on to simply recalling the events. Write them out. Every day for maybe 20 or 30 years, Leonard kept a journal. We have them stretched on his shelf. They were bound, maybe about 10 feet long. He wrote a lot. Keep a journal, a good idea. If you can't get around to keeping a journal, take notes on what you read. Keep a card file box. Type or write quotations that appeal to you, or ideas, and try to get them in, whether in the A thing or whatever. I've never learned to file. I filed some things by the author's names and some things by the topic, but I manage. Also, I would recommend read the books you own. You'll need to own some good books. If you own the book, read the book with a red pencil. Put a check mark beside something that strikes your fancy. If there's some especially quotable sentence or something significant, underline it. If there is something you want to also remember, but it is not quotable, say, but just the gist of what the author is driving at, put a parenthesis around a sentence or around a paragraph. Mark your books in red. When you do that, the mere marking will begin to drive the point home to you, and then next year you want to review the book, you go through it very rapidly. If you are taking a textbook course, I started the practice at one point in college of preparing a regular outline of the chapter. You know, Roman numeral 1, capital letter A, subheading 1, subheading little a, and so on. Outline the chapter, which will fix it in your mind, and I guarantee that if you are tested on that chapter or section, you will do a better job than you maybe have done before.
All right, that was Ed Opitz there, the old Rev. That whole talk, the liberating arts that he gives, I really enjoyed it. And I think there are some challenging ideas that some people would not agree with, including myself. There is so much great stuff already there, so I highly encourage you to check that out. And that also will be listed in the Trivium Binder materials as well. Okay, mental concentration, just what he said. It's so simple, yet it is the most difficult thing to do. I swear it is so hard to do, people. I'm sure you've had experience with it. Now, we have this problem in culture today where we have attention deficit disorder and all this such. It's the fact that we have a culture that doesn't encourage us to concentrate mentally, that doesn't require us to. We have the television attention span, these 30-second commercials. There is so much wrong with the general thinking that goes on in our culture, and a lot of it, I think, can be avoided simply by not only applying the Trivium skills in general, but mental concentration in particular. Because the more we can just quiet our minds and focus on one thing, willfully, consciously focus on one thing at a time, peace surrounds you. Okay? It's just my experience, at least. That's how it is. When you actually really start getting into this skill, and I'm not fully there. I haven't fully mastered this skill yet, let's just say. But I'm getting there. And I have progressed quite a ways since when I first started. I mean, it's just amazing. I couldn't concentrate for very long at all. And now I can, in the middle of chaos around me, I can consciously make that decision to focus, to pinpoint my attention. And very little gets through that. You know, it's hard, but it's so doable, people. And I highly encourage you to try it right away. Do it today. Work on the paraphrase, finding the argument, defining terms, all that stuff. But focus your mind first, okay? Because if you can't focus your mind, you're not going to progress very far on this path at all. I've I wouldn't say I've saved the best skill for last, but I would say that it is probably the most crucial because all else will follow, or not, depending on your ability to focus your mind. So you don't have to go right from a scattered brain to complete Zen-like focus, okay? But you work your way there. You are in control of your life of thought. And when you start to do this, you realize that your life of the life of thought is an accurate term here. It's an accurate phrase for describing our mind. Our minds are very chaotic. There's thoughts that come at us from all different angles, it seems. Stuff is going on, and when you actually start to control it, you realize that you're almost like in the middle of a river, that where once you were just bashed about and brought by the current and the waves, now you're starting to steer yourself. It's going to work. You're going to see a dramatic improvement in your mind just by applying this one skill alone, let alone all of the others that we've talked about here today. Memorization, that's a great technique Opitz talked about for developing the memory. If you want to learn more about that, The Art of Memory by Francis Yates, that's a great book to check out. It covers the ancient rhetorical canon of memoria. Yes, memorization was actually part of the subject of rhetoric once upon a time. Now we have, you know, writing implements galore and electronic devices that help us keep all of our thoughts in track. But before all of this stuff came around, the ancients were able to memorize extremely large amounts of information extremely accurately and to preserve it for long periods of time. These people could remember books word for word. I'm not kidding you. Check it out, The Art of Memory, Francis Yates. There's a lot of techniques in there, and it's amazing stuff. You start to discover this world of liberal education, and you'll find so many connections to other points in history and ideas and developments in the West and throughout the rest of the world. There's just so much going on here, folks. Once you start really getting into this, it helps you get in touch with our roots, our cultural roots in the West, and the world of thought that has been respected the world over by all of the great intellectuals and scientists of our time. So, all right, that's about it for the Trivium skills. If you have any questions, thenextsteppodcast@gmail.com is where you're going to send them. And certainly if they're good, I'm going to incorporate them into version 2.0 of this presentation, which will probably come out maybe a year or so from now. And it will be new and improved. All right, kids, I know you guys are restless, so let me make the next few sections pretty brief. All right, so I'm going to go over a few resources for you guys to check out online, a couple recommended books, and then I'm going to address a few criticisms of the liberal learning path. The first thing to check out is where I found out about the Trivium, Gnostic Media Podcast. That's Jan Irvin's Gnostic Media Podcast. If you go to gnosticmedia.com, you can find his podcast archives there. I believe for non-subscribers, he keeps the most recent 10 episodes always freely available, as well as the Trivium episodes, always freely available. So check that out, gnosticmedia.com. And then a friend and partner of Jan Irvin's is Richard Grove. Now, Richard Grove has the Peace Revolution podcast, where he covers somewhat similar territory to Jan Irvin in that he's looking at some of the behind-the-scenes aspects of our social environment and doing a pretty good job of it, I would say, going to source materials and looking at the facts as far as they have been given by the very people involved in some of the behind-the-scenes activities in the world. So Richard Grove's Peace Revolution podcast, definitely a huge resource for people looking outside of the box. And then he has the Tragedy and Hope networking site. So if you go to tragedyandhope.ning.com, you're going to find the online networking site that Richard Grove has set up, where quite a few people are going and congregating around this idea of learning the Trivium. So there are study groups forming, and people are trying to find each other in similar time schedules across the internet and getting together on things like Skype and other voice over internet protocol programs. And they're starting to learn together, and people post blogs and essays and things like that. So it's a really cool place. to start finding others online who are interested in pursuing this type of education. So Richard Grove's Peace Revolution podcast, and then also his Tragedy and Hope Ning social networking site. Great resources for you to check out. The third is my own edition, and that is the Trivium Binder, which I've mentioned. You can go to triviumbinder.blogspot.com. And the idea behind the Trivium Binder, it came simply just from my own printing out of certain materials and then actually, you know, punching three holes in them and putting them in a three-ring binder. And after a while, I realized, well, you know what? Given some good materials, this could be a really good resource for a beginning student, and that started the idea of the Trivium Binder. So if you go to triviumbinder.blogspot.com, depending on when you hear this, everything should be completed, but it will be always in a state of either nearing completion or adding on to what has originally been completed. There's going to be a set list of materials that are available for download that you then print out and put together. It's categorized and all that stuff. So it basically, you can take a beginning student, walk them through the whole Trivium Binder, and they will have a very firm foundation for the rest of their educational path. It's not going to have everything, but it's going to have some really, really good material for beginners and somewhat intermediate level students as well. But I think it's going to be a hit, so check it out, the Trivium Binder. Also, my presentation you're listening to now is going to be linked there, as well as a whole bunch of other links specific to the general topic of liberal learning, as well as the three specific subjects of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So check that out. You'll see all that's there, and hopefully make some good use of it. Now, here's a couple recommended books for you to check out. A few that I've mentioned and a few that I haven't. One is How to Talk by Clapp and Kane. It's kind of old. It's from the 20s. It's addressed for... it's using rhetoric basically in the everyday scenarios, and sometimes it focuses a little heavily on things like club and organizational activities, but I think the three chapters on self-training alone are worth the $20 or $30 that I spent on the book brand new. So there's three chapters on self-training. I've actually taken the liberty of scanning a lot of the relevant material from How to Talk and making that available with a Trivium Binder project, so you can check that out, although the scans are not very good. But How to Talk by Clapp and Kane, it's a great book. Another one that deals with rhetoric is Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student. Now, this is an expensive book. I think it's about $60 or $70 brand new. But even if you can get a used copy for $30 or $40, it's still worth the price. I mean, it's really a huge resource. It's pretty much an entire college course in one book. And they really do a great job of explaining everything and walking you through the whole process. It pretty much just... it's not everything to do with classical rhetoric, but it has a lot to do with classical rhetoric, as well as understanding it in the light of the modern student, hence the title Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student. They begin with a rhetorical analysis of an HP printer ad, so it's good stuff. If you can get a hold of that, definitely do. Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student, Corbett and Connors, fourth edition, by the way. Another book, Well-Educated Mind, I believe I mentioned before, by Susan Wise Bauer. Now, they have the Well-Trained Mind, which is sort of their homeschooling protocol that I haven't actually looked at yet. But Well-Educated Mind is a great one if you want to start reading the classic literature. They introduce you, again, to the Trivium Method, and they do a pretty good job of it, as well as showing you different ways to approach each genre of the literature, whether it be autobiography or history or poetry or something like that. And then in each genre, they also give a brief synopsis of some of the main works that have been written in each of those. So check that out. Well-Educated Mind. I highly recommend that for the beginning Trivium student. Another one that I really recommend is Teaching the Trivium by Harvey and Lori Bluedorn. Now, this is definitely a book meant and intended for Christian homeschoolers, which is not something that I find myself to be, but even for non-Christian homeschoolers and self-learners, Teaching the Trivium by the Bluedorns is an awesome book. There is so much stuff in there, from teaching children to teaching teenagers, and all of it more or less applies to adults. It goes beyond a lot of the other books that I've seen as far as discussing the use of the Trivium. And you know, again, you have to just kind of find the things that you enjoy about the book and leave the rest behind, you know. So keep that in mind. But Teaching the Trivium by Harvey and Laurie Bluedorn is definitely a book worth buying. Another book on the Trivium is by Sister Miriam Joseph, and this is one that Gino Denning and Jan Irvin will recommend. And it's a good book, but it's not necessarily one that is easy for beginners to work through. The first two or three chapters are pretty easygoing, and then it gets difficult really quickly. I still recommend the beginning student to buy this book, The Trivium by Sister Miriam Joseph, and do what you can with it, but realize that the more that you learn the skills and the subjects and you start applying them, or the skills and the method, I'm sorry, and applying them to the subjects, then you'll start coming back to the Trivium book by Sister Miriam Joseph more so, because you'll have more of a firm footing intellectually and a better grasp of some of these subjects and what is found in them. It's just that Sister Miriam Joseph really did a great job, so great, in fact, that it was a bit too academic for the normal person. But again, worth having. Keep it on your shelf. You'll get to it eventually. Another book, The War Against Grammar by David Mulroy. I can't say enough good about this book. I remember getting it on a hunch, and I have not been disappointed. I've read over it about three or four times. I hope to speak with Mr. Mulroy soon, maybe even for the show. But The War Against Grammar, it's written by an academic, but it somehow gets through, at least to me. The first time I read it, about half of it was kind of boring, like the history of how grammar has been finagled out of the educational system. But then there are other parts that were really colorful for me, like the history of the liberal arts and the context of learning these things and some of the modern teachers that are using a traditional grammar in the way that we would like to see with students. So The War Against Grammar, it's just it's one of those that helps you get the big picture of the liberal arts and then focuses in on one of the subjects, being grammar. And then also you find out about things like sentence diagramming, which is one of the better ways of learning traditional grammar. Okay, and then one more book you've already heard about, Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. I don't agree with everything Benjamin Franklin said, but I do agree with a lot of what he said. He was a man always seeking for virtue, not always finding it, but certainly he was somebody that you can learn a lot from. And as you heard before, he's got some of this Trivium stuff under his belt, and he even credits a book on grammar that had sections on logic and rhetoric as part of his formative education. So there's that. All right, let's get on to the refutation section. This is where I address some of the criticisms of liberal learning. All right, one of the things that people say is that the Trivium, liberal learning, and all this stuff, liberal arts education, it's not for children. And the fact is that it is for children. It's for everybody. Again, it's a universal education. Okay, because what you're doing with the Trivium is learning how to better use your mind to form your thoughts and to use language. And that's something that everybody does, no matter what country you're in, and it's a human thing. So there I say it's universal. Now, if you were to take my presentation alone as evidence of the educational path called the liberal arts, then you would say, yes, it's not for children, because this guy has hardly even talked about how to present this to children. It's mostly, it seems, a remedial education for adults. And that's true for my presentation, but it's not true for the whole of liberal arts. In the Trivium binder, there is some more indications as to how to begin incorporating this education for children. Also in the book Teaching the Trivium by the Bluedorns, you're going to find more information. But essentially, you do have to go about teaching children differently than you would go about teaching teenagers and adults even. But it doesn't mean that there isn't stuff there for them. What you do in the younger age groups is to help them form the basis that will allow them to more readily absorb the lessons that they'll learn later on as they study the liberal arts, the older they get. You're not going to teach, you know, Aristotelian logic to a five-year-old, okay? But again, my presentation doesn't cover that much because I haven't been able to explore that territory as much. And there are others who have, and I will be working with them, and in time, you know, these things will become more available. But for now, realize there is plenty in the liberal arts path for children. It's just you have to incorporate this material for yourself. You have to see the big picture. You have to begin working with it yourself. And again, stressing the arts aspect of the liberal arts, you have to individualize it, be creative, you know your child, know what your child needs, and know what you can give them as far as the liberal arts are concerned. Another criticism of the liberal arts path is that it's not relevant to today's world. It certainly has a history, and it does have a bit of a stigma. The liberal arts path has a bit of a stigma as being something for a bygone era that doesn't really resonate with people in the modern world. And hopefully my presentation has changed that opinion a little bit and shown that actually, yeah, there is plenty still available here for us that can be used to great result. Namely just the subjects and the skills alone, let alone this method. Okay. But, today's world is one that is, it seems to be changing in so many different ways. But one thing that doesn't change is the way that the human mind works and how the human being uses language to create its reality. And again, the Trivium is dealing specifically with thoughts and language. And that, again, is where we create our realities. So today's world has everything to do with... So people learning the Trivium certainly are going to find plenty of material to work with in the modern world. It's not an outdated educational system. It's just one that needs to get dusted off and reformed, at least reinterpreted for the modern audience. And again, hopefully my presentation is doing that. Now, another criticism is that the Trivium is not, as it's presented here by me, by myself, and by others, the Trivium is not relevant to people who already are intellectuals. And I disagree with that because I think it's intellectuals who need to understand this explicit model of the Trivium just as much, if not more so, than those of us who are not intellectuals. Because the smart people out there, you know, the really smart people, they pretty much are already doing these things that I'm talking about normally. It's just part of their habitual life of thought. They already have these skills embedded in them. And they're using the Trivium method just in an unconscious way, more or less. It's not explicit, it's implicit. Okay? It's not something that they can actually just say, in 10 minutes I'm going to write down this whole way of thinking. You know, this model of thinking, because they don't see it as that. They just think they've done a lot of hard work, and they happen to have a little bit more ability with the mind. And so, you know, they're smarter. Which, to a certain extent, is very true. But, again, this model is applicable to all levels of human minds. And so it's the intellectuals who can make the most use of it by seeing this explicit model and therefore becoming better teachers of those who are not intellectuals. And it might not seem like an attractive thing to somebody who's really smart that, okay, well, I'm going to help, you know, less intelligent people work on themselves. They can do that on their own. You know, why do I need to do that? But really, we need better teachers on this planet. We need more teachers, more good teachers, and we need the teachers that exist to be better. And I think that's an argument that will be hard to attack, because certainly this world has many, many problems, and good teachers are hard to find. I've only met a few, a small handful in my life. I mean, good teachers are so rare. So for an intellectual to look at this Trivium method and to look at my presentation and the method that we're presenting here and to say, oh, well, that's not for me, well, I challenge them to take it up and to start tutoring people. You know, make it a public service thing. Make it an aspect of their leisure activity. Because we need so many good teachers out there that we don't have. And our culture, our society, suffers for it. Another criticism is that the liberal arts, the Trivium, it's not a complete education. It deals all with the substance of mind. So it's just not enough. And I agree with that, because we have to have education in many different areas of our life. There are some esotericists that depict the energies that human beings deal with in three ways, in the realm of thinking, feeling, and then action or will. And I like that model. And so if you were to apply the Trivium to that model of thinking, feeling, and willing or action, you could say that the Trivium deals with the education of the mind, of the thoughts, of thinking. And so then that leaves also education of the feeling, of the soul, of the inner life, and then the education of the body, of the physical world. And so learning the trivium doesn't give you everything you need, but it gives you such a leg up. Now let's take an example using this threefold model of thinking, feeling, and willing. Any actions you undertake are going to first be preceded by thoughts and emotions. So the more organized and well understood your thoughts are, then the more you are able to contend with whatever emotions come up within you. And the more you are able to think correctly and choose better emotions over negative ones, the better your actions can become. So we have this idea of learning the trivium to become better people by learning how to make better choices. Right action can be a result of a trivium education if one has that intention. You can take this education and run the other way and say, well, forget the emotional side of human beings, and you can cut that out altogether and just have your thinking life in place and then go straight to action and be very rational and dry and heartless, as you would say. And that, I think, is the flaw of many of the people that we would probably identify as being the, quote, bad guys in this planet. You know, they're all in the head and not in the heart. So we have to have an education for the head, but also an education for the heart and an education for the hands. I would love to see in the future some sort of archetypal teacher figure that has all of these three areas going on for him. You know, a liberal arts education, as well as, you know, emotional, spiritual, inner meditative work, and then the physical education, you know, farming, martial arts, things like that. Somewhat similar to this criticism of the trivium not being a complete education is the idea that it's not enough of a curriculum in schools. And to that as well, I agree, it is not. There's a lot of things in schools that children need to learn to function in society, simply just because our society has become so specialized in some ways and complicated in others. Learning the trivium, if the public school systems in America were to just say we're only going to teach the liberal arts, I just don't think it would be the right thing to do. But I do think it would be right for them to say, let's start with the liberal arts education and build from there. Okay. There's no reason that at least the trivium and some familiarity with the quadrivium, which is the study of matter and number, there's no reason that these things should not be taught in school in the integrated fashion that I'm discussing here today. And that makes all the difference. You can learn these subjects separately, but when you have them in an integrated manner and you have the trivium method and you're using and being taught and applying the trivium skills, that is power. That is not knowledge as power. That's understanding and wisdom as power. All right, so yes, the trivium should not be the entire curriculum for a student, but it should be the basis. It should be something that at least all students have. You can go to different schools where they get different kinds of education, but in general, underneath all of that, we should all have the similarity of receiving, at the very least, the kind of education that the trivium provides, because it's helping us to think better, to speak better, and more or less to engage with reality in a more clear-headed, thoughtful manner. All right? And it also leaves less room for irrational behavior. We are the rational animal. We should start being rational. So those are some of the criticisms of the liberal arts education. Hopefully I've addressed them well enough for you to either agree with me or to have some disagreement that you can send my way. There's a lot of thinking on this entire subject that I have not been able to do yet. And the more I engage in conversation with others, the more thinking about this I'm able to do, and to do in a way that is very universal and approachable.
So, you know, there's so much more to life than just reading books and thinking deep thoughts. But the more we're able to do that, I mean, the greater we can progress as a species, as a culture, as a society, civilization. So that's it for the... That's actually it. We're done, folks. I know you've been sitting here so patiently for so long. And here we are. We're at the end. So, yeah, I'm at the end of my notes. That's it. It's a wrap. So you guys can start packing up, heading home, and hopefully you make some good use out of all this material I presented you with. Remember to check out the Trivium Binder and then the Gnostic Media, Peace Revolution podcasts. But definitely do what you can to incorporate these skills into your life and just use that as your beginning. If studying the Trivium subject seems so daunting to you still, just start with the skills, okay? Focus on exercising with these skills and coming to an understanding of the method. And once you really understand the Trivium method and you're using these Trivium skills, the Trivium subjects are going to be fun. And any other subject you want to learn about is going to be fun, okay? Because you're going to know what to do, all right? Maybe that's just my inner nerd, my inner geek talking, but I think you're going to find it in yourself as well. So let me know. Get back to me on this, guys. I'm willing to listen to all of your criticisms, and I'm open to collaboration on future versions and future edits of this presentation. So hit me up at thenextsteppodcast@gmail.com. All right. Class dismissed.
Change.